"What the fuck?" I asked in honest puzzlement. A long, drawn-out groan in answer. It sounded like Vern. That brought things into focus, and I remembered where I was. But what was everybody doing awake in the middle of the night? Or had I only been asleep for seconds? No, that couldn't be, because a thin sliver of moon was floating dead center in an inky sky. "Don't let it get me," Vern gibbered. "I swear I'll be a good boy. I won't do nothing bad. I'll put the ring up before I take a piss. I'll... With some astonishment, I realized that I was listening to a prayer, or at least the Vern Tessio equivalent of a prayer. I sat bolt upright, scared. "Chris?"
"Shut up, Vern," Chris said.
He was the one crouching and listening.
"It's nothing."
"Oh, yes it is," Teddy said ominously. "It's something."
"What is?"
I asked. I was still sleepy and disoriented, unstrung from my place in space and time. It scared me that I had come in late on whatever had developed, too late to defend myself properly, maybe. As if to answer my question, a long and hollow scream rose languidly from the woods. It was the sort of scream you might expect from a woman dying in extreme agony, in extreme fear. "Oh, dear Jesus!" Vern whimpered, his voice high and filled with tears. He reapplied the bear hug that had awakened me, making it hard for me to breathe and adding to my own terror. I threw him loose with an effort, but he scrambled right back beside me like a puppy which can't think of any place else to go.
"It's that Brower kid,"
Teddy whispered hoarsely. "His ghost's out walking in the woods."
"Oh, God!"
Vern screamed, apparently not crazy about that idea at all. "I promise I won't hawk no more dirty books out of Daly's Market. I promise I won't give my carrots to the dog no more. He floundered there, wanting to bribe God with everything, but unable to think of anything really good in the extremity of his fear. "I won't smoke no more unfiltered cigarettes. I won't say no bad swears. I won't put my bazooka on the offering plate. I won't..."
"Shut up, Vern," Chris said.
And beneath his usual authoritative toughness, I could hear the hollow boom of awe. I wondered if his arms and back and belly were as stiff with goose flesh as my own were, and if the hair on the nape of his neck was trying to stand up in hackles as mine was. Vern's voice dropped to a whisper as he continued to expand the reforms he planned to institute if God would only let him live through this night. "It's a bird, isn't it?" I asked Chris. "No. At least I don't think so. I think it's a wildcat. My dad says they scream bloody murder when they're getting ready to mate. Sounds like a woman, doesn't it?"
"Yeah," I said.
My voice hitched in the middle of the word, and two ice cubes broke off in the gap. "But no woman could scream that loud," Chris said, then added helplessly, "Could she, Gordy?"
"It's his ghost,"
Teddy whispered again. His eyeglasses reflected the moonlight in weak, somehow dreamy smears.
"I'm gonna go look for it."
I don't think he was serious, but we took no chances. When he started to get up, Chris and I hauled him back down. Perhaps we were too rough with him, but our muscles had been turned to cables with fear.
"Let me up, fuckheads," Teddy hissed, struggling.
"If I say I want to go look for it, then I'm going to go look for it. I want to see it. I want to see the ghost. I want to see if..." The wild, sobbing cry rose into the night again, cutting the air like a knife with a crystal blade, freezing us with our hands on Teddy. If he'd been a flag, we would have looked like that picture of the Marines claiming Iwo Jima. The scream climbed with a crazy ease through octave after octave, finally reaching a glassy, freezing edge. It hung there for a moment and then whirled back down again, disappearing into an impossible bass register that buzzed like a monstrous honeybee. This was followed by a burst of what sounded like mad laughter, and then there was silence again.
"Jesus H., bald-headed Christ," Teddy whispered.
And he talked no more of going into the woods to see what was making that screaming noise. All four of us huddled up together, and I thought of running. I doubt if I was the only one. If we'd been tenting in Vern's field, where our folks thought we were, we probably would have run. But Castle Rock was too far, and the thought of trying to run across that trestle in the dark made my blood freeze. Running deeper into Harlow and closer to the corpse of Ray Brower was equally unthinkable. We were stuck. If there was a haunt out there in the woods, what my dad called a goosalem, and it wanted us, it would probably get us. Chris proposed we keep a guard, and everyone was agreeable to that. We flipped for watches, and Vern got the first one. I got the last.
Vern sat up cross-legged by the husk of the campfire while the rest of us lay down again. We huddled together like sheep. I was positive that sleep would be impossible, but I did sleep. A light, uneasy sleep that skimmed through unconsciousness like a sub with its periscope up. My half-sleeping dreams were populated with wild cries that might have been real or might have been only products of my imagination. I saw, or thought I saw, something white and shapeless steal through the trees, like a grotesquely ambulatory bedsheet. At last I slipped into something I knew was a dream. Chris and I were swimming at White's Beach, a gravel pit in Brunswick that had been turned into a miniature lake when the gravel digger struck water. It was where Teddy had seen the kid hit his head and almost drown. In my dream, we were out over our heads, stroking lazily along with a hot July sun blazing down. From behind us on the float came cries and shouts and yells of laughter as kids climbed and dived, or climbed and were pushed. I could hear the empty kerosene drums that held the float up clanging and booming together, a sound not unlike that of church bells, which are so solemn and emptily profound. On the sand and gravel beach, oiled bodies lay face down on blankets. Little kids with buckets squatted on the verge of the water or sat happily flipping muck into their hair with plastic shovels. And teenagers clustered in grinning groups watching the young girls promenade endlessly back and forth in pairs and trios, never alone, the secret places of their bodies wrapped in Janssen tank suits. People walked up the hot sand on the balls of their feet, wincing, to the snack bar. They came back with chips, devil dogs, red ball, popsicles. Mrs. Cody drifted past us on an inflatable rubber raft. She was lying on her back, dressed in her typical September to June school uniform, a gray two-piece suit with a thick sweater instead of a blouse under the jacket, a flower pinned over one almost non-existent breast, thick support hose the color of Canada mints on her legs. Her black old lady's high-heeled shoes were trailing in the water, making small V's. Her hair was blue-rinsed like my mother's and done up in those tight, medicinal-smelling clock-spring curls. Her glasses flashed brutally in the sun. "Watch your steps, boys," she said. "Watch your steps, or I'll hit you hard enough to strike you blind. I can do that. I have been given that power by the school board. Now, Mr. Chambers, mending wall, if you please, by rote." "I tried to give the money back," Chris said. "Old Lady Simon said okay, but she took it. Do you hear me? She took it. Now what are you going to do about it? Are you going to whack her blind?" "Mending wall, Mr. Chambers, if you please, by rote." Chris threw me a despairing glance as if to say, "Didn't I tell you it would be this way?" and then began to tread water. He began, "Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen ground swell under it," and then his head went under, his reciting mouth filling with water. He popped back up, crying, "Help me, Gordy! Help me!" Then he was dragged under again. Looking into the clear water, I could see two bloated, naked corpses holding his ankles. One was Vern, and the other was Teddy, and their open eyes were as blank and pupil-less as the eyes of Greek statues. Their small, prepubescent penises floated limply up from their distended bellies like albino strands of kelp. Chris's head broke water again. He held one hand up limply to me and voiced a screaming, womanish cry that rose and rose, ululating in the hot, sunny summer air. I looked wildly toward the beach, but nobody had heard. The lifeguard, his bronzed, athletic body lolling attractively on the seat at the top of his whitewashed, cruciform wooden tower, just went on smiling down at a girl in a red bathing suit. Chris's scream turned into a bubbling, water-choked gurgle as the corpses pulled him under again, and as they dragged him down to black water, I could see his rippling, distorted eyes turned up to me in a pleading agony. I could see his white, starfish hands held helplessly up to the sun-burnished roof of the water. But instead of diving down and trying to save him, I stroked madly for the shore, or at least to a place where the water would not be over my head. Before I could get there, before I could even get close, I felt a soft, rotted, implacable hand wrap itself around my calf and begin to pull. A scream built up in my chest, but before I could utter it, the dream washed away into a grainy facsimile of reality. It was Teddy, with his hand on my leg. He was shaking me awake. It was my watch. Still half in the dream, almost talking in my sleep, I asked him thickly, "You alive, Teddy?"
No, I'm dead and you're a black nigger, he said crossly. It dispelled the last of the dream. I sat up by the campfire, and Teddy lay down. 20. The others slept heavily through the rest of the night. I was in and out, dozing, waking, dozing again. The night was far from silent. I heard the triumphant screech, squawk of a pouncing owl, the tiny cry of some small animal, perhaps about to be eaten, a larger something blundering wildly through the undergrowth. Under all of this, a steady tone, were the crickets. There were no more screams. I dozed and woke, woke and dozed, and I suppose if I had been discovered standing such a slipshod watch in Lidio, I probably would have been court-martialed and shot. I snapped more solidly out of my last doze, and became aware that something was different. It took a moment or two to figure it out. Although the moon was down, I could see my hands resting on my jeans. My watch said 4:45. It was dawn. I stood, hearing my spine crackle, walked 24 feet away from the lumped-together bodies of my friends, and pissed into a clump of sumac. I was starting to shake the night willies. I could feel them sliding away. It was a fine feeling. I scrambled up the cinders to the railroad tracks and sat on one of the rails, idly chucking cinders between my feet, in no hurry to wake the others. At that precise moment, the new day felt too good to share. Morning came on apace. The noise of the crickets began to drop, and the shadows under the trees and bushes evaporated like puddles after a shower. The air had that peculiar lack of taste that presages the latest hot day in a famous series of hot days. Birds that had maybe cowered all night just as we had done now began to twitter, self-importantly. A wren landed on top of the deadfall from which we had taken our firewood, preened itself, and then flew off. I don't know how long I sat there on the rail, watching the purple steal out of the sky as noiselessly as it had stolen in the evening before. Long enough for my butt to start complaining, anyway. I was about to get up when I looked to my right and saw a deer standing in the railroad bed not 10 yards from me. My heart went up into my throat so high that I think I could have put my hand in my mouth and touched it. My stomach and genitals filled with a hot, dry excitement. I didn't move. I couldn't have moved if I'd wanted to. Her eyes weren't brown, but a dark, dusty black, the kind of velvet you see backgrounding jewelry displays. Her small ears were scuffed suede. She looked serenely at me, head slightly lowered in what I took for curiosity. Seeing a kid with his hair in a sleep scarecrow of whorls and many-tined cowlicks, wearing jeans with cuffs and a brown khaki shirt with elbows mended, and the collar turned up in the hoodie tradition of the day. What I was seeing was some sort of gift, something given with a carelessness that was appalling. We looked at each other for a long time. I think it was a long time. Then she turned and walked off to the other side of the tracks, white bobtail flipping insouciantly. She found grass and began to crop. I couldn't believe it. She had begun to crop. She didn't look back at me, and didn't need to. I was frozen solid. Then the rails started to thrum under my ass, and bare seconds later the doe's head came up, cocked back toward Castle Rock. She stood there, her branch-black nose working on the air, coaxing it a little. Then she was gone, in 3 gangling leaps, vanishing into the woods with no sound but 1 rotted branch, which broke with a sound like a track ref starter gun. I sat there, looking mesmerized at the spot where she had been, until the actual sound of the freight came up through the stillness. Then I skidded back down the bank to where the others were sleeping. The freight's slow, loud passage woke them up, yawning and scratching. There was some funny, nervous talk about the case of the screaming ghost, as Chris called it, but not as much as you might imagine. In daylight it seemed more foolish than interesting, almost embarrassing, best forgotten. It was on the tip of my tongue to tell them about the deer, but I ended up not doing it. That was one thing I kept to myself. I've never spoken or written of it until just now, today. And I have to tell you that it seems a lesser thing written down, damn near inconsequential. But for me it was the best part of that trip, the cleanest part. And it was a moment I found myself returning to, almost helplessly, when there was trouble in my life.
My first day in the bush in Vietnam, and this fellow walked into the clearing where we were with his hand over his nose. And when he took his hand away, there was no nose there because it had been shot off. The time the doctor told us our youngest son might be hydrocephalic. He turned out to just have an oversized head, thank God. The long, crazy weeks before my mother died, I would find my thoughts turning back to that morning, the scuffed suede of her ears, the white flash of her tail. But 800 million red Chinese don't give a shit, right? The most important things are the hardest to say, because words diminish them. It's hard to make strangers care about the good things in your life. 21. The tracks now bent southwest and ran through tangles of second-growth fir and heavy underbrush. We got a breakfast of late blackberries from some of these bushes, but berries never fill you up. Your stomach just gives them a 30-minute option and then begins growling again. We went back to the tracks. It was about 8 o'clock by then, and took five. Our mouths were a dark purple, and our naked torsos were scratched from the blackberry brambles. Vern wished glumly aloud for a couple of fried eggs with bacon on the side. That was the last day of the heat, and I think it was the worst of all. The early scud of clouds melted away, and by 9 o'clock the sky was a pale steel color that made you feel hotter just looking at it. The sweat rolled and ran from our chests and backs, leaving clean streaks through the accumulated soot and grime. Mosquitoes and black flies whirled and dipped around our heads in aggravating clouds. Knowing that we had long miles to go didn't make us feel any better, yet the fascination of the thing drew us on and kept us walking faster than we had any business doing in that heat. We were all crazy to see that kid's body. I can't put it any more simply or honestly than that. Whether it was harmless, or whether it turned out to have the power to murder sleep with 100 mangled dreams, we wanted to see it. I think that we had come to believe we deserved to see it. It was about 9:30 when Teddy and Chris spotted water up ahead. They shouted to Vern and me. We ran over to where they were standing. Chris was laughing, delighted. "Look there, beavers did that," he pointed. It was the work of beavers, all right. A large bore culvert ran under the railroad embankment a little way ahead, and the beavers had sealed the right end with one of their neat and industrious little dams, sticks and branches cemented together with leaves, twigs, and dried mud. Beavers are busy little fuckers, all right. Behind the dam was a clear and shining pool of water, brilliantly mirroring the sunlight. Beaver houses humped up and out of the water in several places. They looked like wooden igloos. A small creek trickled into the far end of the pool, and the trees which bordered it were gnawed a clean bone white to a height of almost 3 feet in places. "Railroad will clean this shit out pretty soon," Chris said. "Why?" Vern asked. "They can't have a pool here," Chris said. "It'd undercut their precious railroad line. That's why they put that culvert in there to start with. They'll shoot 'em some beavers and scare off the rest, and then knock out their dam. Then this'll go back to being a bog like it probably was before." "I think that eats the meat," Teddy said. Chris shrugged. "Who cares about beavers? Not the great southern and western Maine, that's for sure." "You think it's deep enough to swim in?" Vern asked, looking hungrily at the water. "One way to find out," Teddy said. "Who goes first?" I asked. "Me," Chris said. He went running down the bank, kicking off his sneakers and untying his shirt from around his waist with a jerk. He pushed his pants and undershorts down with a single shove of his thumbs. He balanced first on one leg and then on the other to get his socks. Then he made a shallow dive. He came up shaking his head to get his wet hair out of his eyes. "It's fucking great!" he shouted. "How deep?" Teddy called back. He had never learned to swim. Chris stood up in the water and his shoulders broke the surface. I saw something on one of them, a blackish-grayish something. Decided it was a piece of mud and dismissed it. If I had looked more closely, I could have saved myself a lot of nightmares later on. "Come on in, you chickens!" He turned and thrashed off across the pool in a clumsy breaststroke, turned over and thrashed back. By then we were all getting undressed. Vern was in next, then me. Hitting the water was fantastic, clean and cool. I swam across the Chris, loving the silky feel of having nothing on but water. I stood up, and we grinned into each other's faces. "Boss!" We said it at exactly the same moment. fucking jerk-off," he said, splashed water in my face, and swam off the other way. We goofed off in the water for almost half an hour before we realized that the pond was full of bloodsuckers. We dived, swam underwater, ducked each other. We never knew a thing. Then Vern swam into the shallower part, went under, and stood on his hands. When his legs broke water in a shaky but triumphant V, I saw that they were covered with blackish-gray lumps, just like the ones I had seen on Chris's shoulder. They were slugs, big ones. Chris's mouth dropped open, and I felt all the blood in my body go as cold as dry ice. Teddy screamed, his face going pale. Then all three of us were thrashing for the bank, going just as fast as we could. I know more about freshwater slugs now than I did then, but the fact that they are mostly harmless has done nothing to allay the almost insane horror of them I've had ever since that day in the beaver pool. They carry a local anesthetic and an anticoagulant in their alien saliva, which means that the host never feels a thing when they attach themselves. If you don't happen to see them, they'll go on feeding until their swelled, loathsome bodies fall off you, sated, or until they actually burst. We pulled ourselves up on the bank, and Teddy went into a hysterical paroxysm as he looked down at himself. He was screaming as he picked the leeches off his naked body. Vern broke the water and looked at us, puzzled. "What the hell's wrong with leeches?" Teddy screamed, pulling two of them off his trembling thighs and throwing them just as far as he could. "Dirty motherfucking bloodsuckers!" His voice broke shrilly on the last word. "Oh, God, oh, God, oh, God, oh, God," Vern cried. He paddled across the pool and stumbled out. I was still cold. The heat of the day had been suspended. I kept telling myself to catch hold, not to get screaming, not to be a pussy. I picked half a dozen off my arms and several more off my chest. Chris turned his back to me. "Gordy, there any more? Take them off if there are. Please, Gordy." There were more, five or six, running down his back like grotesque black buttons. I pulled their soft, boneless bodies off him. I brushed even more off my legs, then got Chris to do my back. I was starting to relax a little, and that was when I looked down at myself and saw the granddaddy of them all clinging to my testicles, its body swelled to four times its normal size. Its blackish-gray skin had gone a bruised purplish-red. That was when I began to lose control. Not outside, at least not in any big way, but inside, where it counts. I brushed its slick, glutinous body with the back of my hand. It held on. I tried to do it again and couldn't bring myself to actually touch it. I turned to Chris, tried to speak, couldn't. I pointed instead. His cheeks, already ashy, went whiter still. "I can't get it off," I said through numb lips. "You... can you..." But he backed away, shaking his head, his mouth twisted. "I can't, Gordy," he said, unable to take his eyes away. "I'm sorry, but I can't. No, oh, no." He turned away, bowed with one hand pressed to his midsection like the butler in a musical comedy, and was sick in a stand of juniper bushes. "You got to hold on to yourself," I thought, looking at the leech that hung off me like a crazy beard. Its body was still visibly swelling. "You got to hold on to yourself and get him. Be tough. It's the last one. The last one." I reached down again and picked it off, and it burst between my fingers. My own blood ran across my palm and inner wrist in a warm flood. I began to cry. Still crying, I walked back to my clothes and put them on. I wanted to stop crying, but I just didn't seem able to turn off the waterworks. Then the shakes set in, making it worse. Vern ran up to me, still naked. "They off, Gordy? They off me? They off me?" He twirled in front of me like an insane dancer on a carnival stage. "They off, huh? Huh? They off me, Gordy?" His eyes kept going past me, as wide and white as the eyes of a plaster horse on a merry-go-round. I nodded that they were and just kept on crying. It seemed that crying was going to be my new career. I tucked my shirt in and then buttoned it all the way to the neck. I put on my socks and my sneakers. Little by little, the tears began to slow down. Finally, there was nothing left but a few hitches and moans, and then they stopped too. Chris walked over to me, wiping his mouth with a handful of elm leaves. His eyes were wide and mute and apologetic. When we were all dressed, we just stood there, looking at each other for a moment. And then we began to climb the railroad embankment. I looked back once at the burst leech lying on top of the tromped-down bushes where we had danced and screamed and groaned them off. It looked deflated, but still ominous. 14 years later, I sold my first novel and made my first trip to New York. "It's going to be a 3-day celebration," my new editor told me over the phone. "People slinging bullshit will be summarily shot." But, of course, it was 3 days of unmitigated bullshit. While I was there, I wanted to do all the standard out-of-towner things. See a stage show at the Radio City Music Hall, go to the top of the Empire State Building, fuck the World Trade Center. The building King Kong climbed in 1933 is always going to be the tallest one in the world for me. Visit Times Square by night. Keith, my editor, seemed more than pleased to show his city off. The last touristy thing we did was to take a ride on the Staten Island Ferry, and while leaning on the rail, I happened to look down and see scores of used condoms floating on the mild swells, and I had a moment of almost total recall. Or perhaps it was an actual incidence of time travel. Either way, for 1 second I was literally in the past, pausing halfway up that embankment and looking back at the burst leech, dead, deflated, but still ominous. Keith must have seen something in my face, because he said, "Not very pretty, are they?" I only shook my head, wanting to tell him not to apologize, wanting to tell him that you didn't have to come to the Apple and ride the ferry to see used rubbers, wanting to say, the only reason anyone writes stories is so they can understand the past and get ready for some future mortality. That's why all the verbs in stories have ED endings, Keith, my good man, even the ones that sell millions of paperbacks. The only two useful art forms are religion and stories. I was pretty drunk that night, as you may have guessed. What I did tell him was, I was thinking of something else, that's all. The most important things are the hardest things to say. 22. We walked further down the tracks. I don't know just how far, and I was starting to think, well, okay, I'm going to be able to handle it. It's all over anyway. Just a bunch of leeches. What the fuck? I was still thinking it when waves of whiteness suddenly began to come over my sight, and I fell down. I must have fallen hard, but landing on the cross ties was like plunging into a warm and puffy feather bed. Someone turned me over. The touch of hands was faint and unimportant. Their faces were disembodied balloons looking down at me from miles up. They looked the way the ref's face must look to a fighter who has been punched silly and is currently taking a 10-second rest on the canvas. Their words came in, gentle oscillations fading in and out. "Him? Be all. If you think the sun..." "Gordy, are you..." Then I must have said something that didn't make much sense because they began to look really worried. "We better take him back, man," Teddy said, and then the whiteness came over everything again. When it cleared, I seemed to be all right. Chris was squatting next to me saying, "Can you hear me, Gordy? You there, man?" "Yes," I said, and sat up. A swarm of black dots exploded in front of my eyes and then went away. I waited to see if they'd come back, and when they didn't, I stood up. "You scared the cheesy old shit out of me, Gordy," he said. "Do you want a drink of water?" "Yeah." He gave me his canteen, half full of water, and I let 3 warm gulps roll down my throat. "Why'd you faint, Gordy?" Vern asked anxiously. "Made a bad mistake and looked at your face," I said. "Hee-hee-hee," Teddy cackled. "Fucking Gordy, you wet." "You really okay?" Vern persisted. "Yeah, sure. It was bad there for a minute, thinking about those suckers." They nodded soberly. We took 5 in the shade and then went on walking, me and Vern on one side of the tracks again, Chris and Teddy on the other. We figured we must be getting close. 23. We weren't as close as we thought, and if we'd had the brains to spend 2 minutes looking at a road map, we would have seen why. We knew that Ray Brower's corpse had to be near the Back Harlow Road, which dead-ends on the bank of the Royal River. Another trestle carries the GS and WM tracks across the Royal, so this is the way we figured. Once we got close to the Royal, we'd be getting close to the Back Harlow Road, where Billy and Charlie had been parked when they saw the boy. and since the Royal was only 10 miles from Castle River, we figured that we had it made in the shade. But that was 10 miles as the crow flies, and the tracks didn't move on a straight line between the castle and the Royal. Instead, they made a very shallow loop to avoid a hilly, crumbling region called the Bluffs. Anyway, we could have seen that loop quite clearly if we had looked on a map and figured out that instead of 10 miles, we had about 16 to walk. Chris began to suspect the truth when noon had come and gone and the Royal still wasn't in sight. We stopped while he climbed a high pine tree and took a look around. He came down and gave us a simple enough report. It was going to be at least 4 in the afternoon before we got to the Royal, and we would only make it by then if we humped right along.
Ah, shit, Teddy cried. So what are we going to do now?
We looked into each other's tired, sweaty faces. We were hungry and out of temper. The big adventure had turned into a long slog, dirty and sometimes scary. We would have been missed back home by now, too. And if Milo Pressman hadn't already called the cops on us, the engineer of the train crossing the trestle might have done it. We had been planning to hitchhike back to Castle Rock, but 4 o'clock was just 3 hours from dark, and nobody gives 4 kids on a backcountry road a lift after dark. I tried to summon up the cool image of my deer, cropping at green morning grass, but even that seemed dusty, and no good, no better than a stuffed trophy over the mantel in some guy's hunting lodge, the eyes sprayed to give him that phony, lifelike shine. Finally, Chris said, "It's still closer out going ahead. Let's go." He turned and started to walk along the tracks in his dusty sneakers, head down, his shadow only a puddle at his feet. After a minute or so, the rest of us followed him, strung out in Indian file. 24. In the years between then and the writing of this memoir, I've thought remarkably little about those 2 days in September, at least consciously. The associations the memories bring to the surface are as unpleasant as week-old river corpses brought to the surface by cannon fire. As a result, I never really questioned our decision to walk down the tracks. Put another way, I've wondered sometimes about what we had decided to do, but never how we did it. But now a much simpler scenario comes to mind. I'm confident that if the idea had come up, it would have been shot down. Walking down the tracks would have seemed neater, bosser, as we said then. But if the idea had come up and hadn't been shot down in flames, none of the things which occurred later would have happened. Maybe Chris and Teddy and Vern would even be alive today. No, they didn't die in the woods or on the railroad tracks. Nobody dies in this story except some bloodsuckers and Ray Brower. And if you want to be completely fair about it, he was dead before it even started. But it is true that of the 4 of us who flipped coins to see who would go down to the Florida market to get supplies, only the one who actually went is still alive. The Ancient Mariner at 34, with you, gentle reader, in the role of wedding guest. At this point, shouldn't you flip to the jacket photo to see if my eye holdeth you in its spell? If you sense a certain flipness on my part, you're right. But maybe I have cause. At an age when all 4 of us would be considered too young and immature to be president, 3 of us are dead. And if small events really do echo up larger and larger through time, yes, maybe if we had done the simple thing and simply hitched into Harlow, they would still be alive today. We could have hooked a ride all the way up Route 7 to the Shiloh Church, which stood at the intersection of the highway and the back Harlow Road, at least until 1967, when it was leveled by a fire attributed to a tramp's smoldering cigarette butt. With reasonable luck, we could have gotten to where the body was by sundown of the previous day. But the idea wouldn't have lived. It wouldn't have been shot down with tightly buttressed arguments and debating society rhetoric, but with grunts and scowls and farts and raised middle fingers. The verbal part of the discussion would have been carried forward with such trenchant and sparkling contributions as "fuck no," and "that sucks," and that old reliable standby, "did your mother have any kids that lived?" Unspoken, maybe it was too fundamental to be spoken, was the idea that this was a big thing. It wasn't screwing around with firecrackers or trying to look through the knothole in the back of the girl's privy at Harrison State Park. This was something on a par with getting laid for the first time, or going into the army, or buying your first bottle of legal liquor, just bopping into that state store if you can dig it, selecting a bottle of good scotch, showing the clerk your draft card and driver's license, then walking out with a grin on your face and that brown bag in your hand, member of a club with just a few more rights and privileges than our old treehouse with a tin roof. There's a high ritual to all fundamental events. The rites of passage, the magic corridor where the change happens, buying the condoms, standing before the minister, raising your hand and taking the oath, or, if you please, walking down the railroad tracks to meet a fellow your own age halfway, the same as I'd walk halfway over to Pine Street to meet Chris if he was coming over to my house, or the way Teddy would walk halfway down Gate Street to meet me if I was going to his. It seemed right to do it this way, because the rite of passage is a magic corridor, and so we always provide an aisle. It's what you walk down when you get married, what they carry you down when you get buried. Our corridor was those twin rails, and we walked between them, just hopping along toward whatever this was supposed to mean. You don't hitchhike your way to a thing like that, maybe. And maybe we thought it was also right that it should have turned out to be harder than we had expected. Events surrounding our hike had turned it into what we had suspected it was all along. Serious business. What we didn't know as we walked around the bluffs was that Billy Tessio, Charlie Hogan, Jack Mudgett, Norman Fuzzy Brackowitz, Vince Desjardins, Chris's older brother Eyeball, and Ace Merrill himself were all on their way to take a look at the body themselves. In a weird kind of way, Ray Brower had become famous, and our secret had turned into a regular road show. They were piling into Ace's chopped and channeled 52 Ford and Vince's pink 54 Studebaker even as we started on the last leg of our trip. Billy and Charlie had managed to keep their enormous secret for just about 36 hours. Then Charlie spilled it to Ace while they were shooting pool, and Billy had spilled it to Jack Mudgett while they were fishing for steelies from the Boom Road Bridge. Both Ace and Jack had sworn solemnly on their mother's names to keep the secret, and that was how everybody in their gang knew about it by noon. Guess you could tell what those assholes thought about their mothers. They all congregated down at the pool hall, and Fuzzy Brackowitz advanced a theory, which you have heard before, gentle reader, that they could all become heroes, not to mention instant radio and TV personalities, by discovering the body. All they had to do, Fuzzy maintained, was to take two cars with a lot of fishing gear in the trunks. After they found the body, their story would be 100%. We were just planning to take a few pickerel out of the Royal River, officer. Look what we found. They were burning up the road from Castle Rock to the back Harlow area just as we started to finally get close. 25. Clouds began to build in the sky around 2 o'clock. But at first none of us took them seriously. It hadn't rained since the early days of July, so why should it rain now? But they kept building to the south of us, up and up and up, thunderheads in great pillars as purple as bruises, and they began to move slowly our way. I looked at them closely, checking for that membrane beneath that means it's already raining 20 miles away or 50. But there was no rain yet. The clouds were still just building. Vern got a blister on his heel, and we stopped and rested while he packed the back of his left sneaker with moss stripped from the bark of an old oak tree. "Is it going to rain, Gordy?" Teddy asked. "I think so." "Pisser," he said, and sighed. "That pisser, good end to a pisser good day." I laughed, and he tipped me a wink. We started to walk again, a little more slowly now, out of respect for Vern's hurt foot. And in the hour between 2 and 3, the quality of the day's light began to change, and we knew for sure that rain was coming. It was just as hot as ever, and even more humid, but we knew. And the birds did. They seemed to appear from nowhere, and swoop across the sky, chattering and crying shrilly to each other. And the light, from a steady, beating brightness, it seemed to evolve into something filtered, almost pearly. Our shadows, which had begun to grow long again, also grew fuzzy and ill-defined. The sun had begun to sail in and out through the thickening decks of clouds, and the southern sky had gone a coppery shade. We watched the thunderheads lumber closer, fascinated by their size and their mute threat. Every now and then it seemed that a giant flash bulb had gone off inside one of them, turning their purplish, bruised color momentarily to a light gray. I saw a jagged fork of lightning lick down from the underside of the closest. It was bright enough to print a blue tattoo on my retinas. It was followed by a long, shaking blast of thunder. We did a little bitching about how we were going to get caught out in the rain, but only because it was the expected thing. Of course, we were all looking forward to it. It would be cold and refreshing and leech-free. At a little past 3:30, we saw running water through a break in the trees. "That's it!" Chris yelled jubilantly. "That's the Royal!" We began to walk faster, taking our second wind. The storm was getting close now. The air began to stir, and it seemed that the temperature dropped 10 degrees in the space of seconds. I looked down and saw that my shadow had disappeared entirely. We were walking in pairs again, each two watching a side of the railroad embankment. My mouth was dry, throbbing with a sickish tension. The sun sailed behind another cloud bank, and this time it didn't come back out. For a moment, the bank's edges were embroidered with gold, like a cloud in an Old Testament Bible illustration, and then the wine-colored, dragging belly of the thunder had blotted out all traces of the sun. The day became gloomy. The clouds were rapidly eating up the last of the blue. We could smell the river so clearly that we might have been horses, or perhaps it was the smell of rain impending in the air as well. There was an ocean above us, held in by a thin sack that might rupture and let down a flood at any second. I kept trying to look into the underbrush, but my eyes were continually drawn back to that turbulent, racing sky. In its deepening colors you could read whatever doom you liked, water, fire, wind, hail. The cool breeze became more insistent, hissing in the firs. A sudden, impossible bolt of lightning flashed down, seemingly from directly overhead, making me cry out and clap my hands to my eyes. God had taken my picture, a little kid with his shirt tied around his waist, duck bumps on his bare chest and cinders on his cheeks. I heard the rending fall of some big tree not 60 yards away. The crack of thunder which followed made me cringe. I wanted to be at home reading a good book in a safe place, like down in the potato cellar. "Jesus!" Vern screamed in a high, fainting voice. "Oh, my Jesus Christ, look at that!" I looked in the direction Vern was pointing and saw a blue-white fireball bowling its way up the left-hand rail of the GS and WM tracks, crackling and hissing for all the world like a scalded cat. It hurried past us as we turned to watch it go, dumbfounded, aware for the first time that such things could exist. 20 feet beyond us, it made a sudden pop and just disappeared, leaving a greasy smell of ozone behind. "What am I doing here anyway?" Teddy muttered. "What a pisser!" Chris exclaimed happily, his face upturned. "This is gonna be a pisser like you wouldn't believe!" But I was with Teddy. Looking up at that sky gave me a dismaying sense of vertigo. It was more like looking into some deeply mysterious marbled gorge. Another lightning bolt crashed down, making us duck. This time the ozone smell was hotter, more urgent. The following clap of thunder came with no perceptible pause at all. My ears were still ringing from it when Vern began to screech triumphantly, "There! There he is! Right there, I see him!